Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:21 PM, and that is Central Time. Today is March 4th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought I'd kick off with just an intraday chart of the NASDAQ, because from about mid-morning today, we had a fairly impressive rally, and it was down to a big block trade by an algorithm. So when we think about algorithms, they necessarily have to reduce positions when volatility rises. Something, a point I've made on many occasions in the past, is that you can program your system any way you want, and you can make buying decisions on what to buy in any fashion you like. But it's very difficult to figure out how much to buy. And you make that determination in a very limited number of ways. And the primary way that you make that determination is with volatility. And I think that's really the main impressive conclusion that Ray Dalio made when he invented risk parity analysis. And that was basically netting off volatility between bonds and equities in a balanced portfolio, and then running with that strategy for a long period of time. So when we look at the VIX, it got up to 35, and then wasn't quite able to hold it and gave up most of the advance. So what we have definitely got evidence of in here today is that when volatility starts to come back down, then there are programs in the market that are automatically going to commit capital, because volatility is high, and it's higher and it's sustaining a higher value now than at any time for a decade. So even when we think about the big moves up during crises like in 2020, it really just went up and straight back down again. And what we're now seeing is that there's a bunching of trade around this 30 level, which has lasted for almost as long as the initial surge and decline during the pandemic panic. And we have to really go back to 2007 to see something similar. And even then, volatility was somewhat lower than it is today. So understandably, people are experiencing a lot of stress. And one thing that I found interesting today, at least in the last 24 hours, I've had two different people asking me about stops and what would be an appropriate stop to have. And let's just look at the two shares that they asked me about. One was Peabody Energy. So it's just broken out of a first step above the base formation. Now, obviously, what's happening with coal is a very unique set of circumstances. And it's entirely down to what's happening between Russia and Ukraine in Ukraine. So this is obviously creating demand for coal where there hadn't been quite the need for it just 2 weeks ago. But when you see a breakout like this, then obviously people will be looking at a significant paper profit in a short period of time, and they want to protect it, and they're worrying about where to put a stop. In other words, they're worried that they're going to lose their profit. But of course, that's also a factor of the high volatility that we've had. So we've had a lot of choppy action, and people are nervous about their positions. And because so many stocks have had large declines, when something goes up and you suddenly see green on the portfolio and you're doing well, well, then people want to think about selling. So one might think about putting in a stop somewhere below the $20 level. One might think about the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But the more important point is that it's broken out of a base formation in 2021. It had a consolidation and found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And if this trend is going to remain consistent, well, then it will hold the breakout. So this looks like a new uptrend. And Arch Coal is also popping on the upside here. Now, it's been trending higher for somewhat longer. So it broke out 6 weeks ago, and then it was up in a really dynamic manner in here today. But we need to look at lots of back history just to get a consideration for just how much prices have gone up. And I guess Arch Coal and Arch Resources, they cut off their old price history. But this is obviously an acceleration of the trend, but it's nothing compared with the really big acceleration that we've seen in oil prices. So oil was up another $7 in here today. And this has all the hallmarks of a classic oil shock. So on this occasion, it's not that Russia is saying they're not going to sell their oil, it's that we can't buy it because of the nefarious activities that they're engaged in Ukraine. So the price has pretty much started to go vertical. In fact, it's now rising faster than it did back in 2008. And it's going to continue to rise until one, demand starts to ebb, or two, we see a new source of supply coming to the market. So politicians are desperate to get oil prices back down because, for one thing, in the USA they have the midterm elections in November, and it's only 6 months away. So that's obviously going to be a really significant consideration. They want to get the oil price down as quick as possible because the incumbent party is under a great deal of pressure. And then we have the rest of the world who are all oil consumers too. But the more important point here is that the dollar is rising, which means that other currencies are falling against it. So this is a more difficult environment for Europe. When we look at the euro, and this is going to then look like a much more pronounced breakout because the euro has been making new lows. So we have oil prices at new all-time highs, and this has been an incredible advance where we've gone from 60 to 108 in the space of about 8 or 9 weeks. And this is an energy crisis for Europe, but it's an energy crisis for lots of places. So the UK, the pound hasn't been quite as weak as the euro has. In fact, it's been breaking out against the euro. But when we look at it when relative to the oil price, we're at a new all-time high as well. So we're looking at the real potential here for an oil crisis. And if we go back and think about the 1970s, well, it's going to kick off inflation. Spikes in oil contribute to deflationary pressures. So the cure for high prices is high prices. And if we are seeing a supply deficit and prices rising into a vacuum of supply, well, ultimately it will kill off demand. And if it kills off demand, well, then what we're looking at is the real potential that we're going to have a recession. But of course, it's going to be a bigger problem for major importers. And the major importers are primarily Europe, Japan, India. So these are obviously going to be significant challenges for these countries as oil prices ramp higher. Now, when we then think about gold, well, gold prices are also on the front foot here and pushing on to new highs. So in pounds, we're through the 1400 pound level and coming up into the 1500 pounds an ounce level. Again, the euro has been weaker, so now gold is breaking out to a new all-time high relative to the euro. One thing that has been a particularly interesting hallmark of this corrective phase is that the yen has not accumulated the same interest as a safe haven as it would normally do. And there's a good reason for that. The Bank of Japan is not in any way, shape, or form talking about raising interest rates. So gold is now breaking out against the yen as well. And then in US dollar terms, it has cleared the $1,900 area and was up another 33 in here today as it pushes up towards the big psychological 2000 level. The chart that I think is most interesting about gold is the long-term chart of gold in purchasing power parity terms, because we got up to test the high from the 1980s in 20 to 2020, or we got, excuse me, we got to back to test the peak from 2012 in 2020. And then if we go back and look at the period in 1980, well, then we have another significant peak. And unfortunately, we need to look at the monthly chart to get that, and then we're not going to get the spike peak from the 1980s. So there was a somewhat higher high that only lasted for a day and will not show up on the monthly chart. But I think the correlation here between the peaks in 2011, 2020, and 1980 is really quite remarkable. And also that the price of gold bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average and is now pushing higher suggests that we're going to see gold at new all-time highs on a purchasing power parity basis before very long. And that's most particularly interesting from the perspective of safe haven assets, because we're in a new inflationary environment. Now, there was the real possibility that inflationary pressures could have peaked in the second half of this year. And then on a year-over-year basis, maybe inflation could have come back down to about 4% or maybe even 3.5%. And central bankers would then have been able to say, well, golly, job done. We don't have to raise rates as much as we had feared. That obviously is under threat right now because oil prices are ramping higher. Now, if politicians are so desperate that they will sign any deal to get Iran's oil back onto the international markets, well, then there's, and I think that that's a likely prospect because they're terrified of losing elections and alienating their domestic populations because they can't get a handle on inflation. Well, then it's probably going to allow Iran to be a nuclear power within the next 2 or 3 years. That'll set off a nuclear arms race within the Middle East. And of course, there are two big lessons that the world will have taken from, I guess there might be three big lessons from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The first is you can't rely on a despotic regime for vital commodities, because you just don't know when they're going to turn on you, and that's exactly what's happened with Russia. Russia believed that they can do whatever they want because they have a stranglehold on Europe's energy, and they also have nuclear weapons. And those kinds of bully tactics allowed them to think that they could just invade Ukraine with no repercussions. And of course, they were able to take over Crimea in 2014, and they were appeased. So that appeasement strategy did not work, and now we're in a situation where they're trying to take over the whole country. And there are obvious historical comparisons to look at in that regard. The next lesson is that you don't give up your nuclear weapons for any reason. So Ukraine had nuclear weapons. In fact, they're one of the only countries that voluntarily gave up nuclear weapons and then accepted the assurances of the West and Russia that their territorial integrity would remain intact. Well, that didn't last for 20 years, and now Russia is trying to take over the whole country. So then of course, the corollary there is that the obvious deterrent to invasion is nuclear weapons. That's certainly what India concluded, and it's also what Pakistan concluded, and every other nuclear country. So It makes sense then that every country is going to pursue a some form of nuclear deterrent in future, and most particularly those that have got a very close proximity to a potentially dangerous neighbor. And of course, I'm thinking of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. These are obviously going to be significant challenges in the future, because China isn't has got no interest in any of those countries wanting getting a nuclear deterrent, and it obviously would then take the military option off the table, so they would be then forced to invade before they have their nuclear deterrent. So this is obviously a it's a very significant development about what's going on in Russia. And of course, the third lesson is you can't trust Russia. And we have lots of examples. There's a really interesting documentary series on Netflix right now about, I think it's called Spycraft. And they go into quite a bit of detail about how Russia has used nuclear munitions to poison people. And obviously, this is a significant challenge, and it caused a mild diplomatic issue between the UK and Russia for a while, and it's certainly soured relations between the two countries, but it didn't lead to outright war. But what it does suggest is that nobody's going to trust Russia in future when they say one thing is going to be a really significant part of this market as well. And the price of lithium has been ramping higher, and it isn't really showing any signs of slowing down. So we're seeing supply inelasticity meet significant rising demand, and this could persist for the lengthy medium term. It's going to take years to bring new lithium supply into the market. What we're also starting to see is that the tanker companies are starting to attract interest. The Dirty Tanker Index broke out to significant new highs this week, and it looks again to be in the process of completing the base formation. Then we saw that the Baltic Dry Index had completed its base formation, then gave up the entire advance, and now it's starting to find support once more. We're going to see a really significant change in the supply chains, not only because of the pandemic, which impacted supply chains everywhere, but now we're also seeing that the wider sector, or the wider global economy, is going to have to turn itself inside out again to try and get around Russia. When lots of airlines aren't flying in there anymore, and they're not allowing Russian planes to fly out, when Russian companies can't take payment for imports or exports, then trade grinds to a halt. We're seeing, for example, in the wheat market that prices are just ramping higher, and they were limit up almost every day this week and limit up again in here today. So this is a really profound change. We're up to $12 a bushel. And we're at not quite new all-time highs, but on a closing basis on a week, this is a new high. And this is going to have significant issues for different countries. And we're already starting to see stresses forming in places like Egypt. And the market there is just about holding the sequence of higher reaction lows in dollar terms. So these, I think, are some of the challenges that we're going to see in what's an evolving energy crisis. And inflationary pressures are front and center, and real assets are starting to respond. And central banks are going to have an exceedingly difficult time raising interest rates. When we go back and then think about the total return on US 10-year treasuries. I've looked at this chart on many occasions over the years, and it looks to me at least that it's attempting to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. This isn't the first time it's been back testing this level, and it's unlikely to be the last. But it's never sustained a move below it. So when we think about what the outlook is for bonds, on the one hand, we have the Dow, excuse me, we have the copper gold ratio on the cusp of breaking out, and that being a lead indicator for higher yields. Well, higher yields would be bearish for the total return on bonds, and it would break downwards. On the other hand, if we see that central banks are determined to favor growth over containing inflation, then yields may compress somewhat. Or if we start to see economic growth recovering, or we start to see commodity prices easing for whatever reason, well, then that would allow central banks to pull back from raising rates. But the one thing that we certainly know is that if the bond market rolls over and breaks its uptrend, then the most secure part of many portfolios will start to look like real trouble. And that's going to create demand for alternatives. So, in a rising interest rate, higher yield environment, the alternatives that have worked for the last 20 years have been private equity. So, when we think about, for example, KKR or any one of the other listed private equity companies, they did exceptionally well in the period up from the lows in 2020, and now they're pulling back exceptionally quickly. And Brookfield has been among the really the best managed of the active private equity companies, and it's just about holding on here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And a good part of the reason for that is because of their focus on property. So property prices remain firm, and that's helping to support the portfolio. So they have concentrated on real assets, and that's insulating them from some of the challenges that we see right now. Whereas the innovation portion of the market has really been pulling back in an aggressive manner. Again, the ARK Innovation ETF had rebounded impressively last week and has now given up just about all of the advance. So we still have a consistent medium-term bear market, even though it's unwound all of the breakout from above that initial peak in early 2020. It's still going downwards. So we're starting to see that liquidity issues are beginning to appear. And we're not at danger levels yet on the high yield market, but it is rising. It's up to 388 basis points. And the high yield ETF is now also breaking downwards. So that's also problematic. And then we can think about, let me see if I can find this chart. So if we look at the FRA OIS spread, it's clearly broken higher. So now it's only up to 23 basis points, and that's really not a lot. But when we're thinking about forward rate agreements and overnight index swaps and the spread between the two, well, what it's beginning to suggest is that people aren't really willing to commit to having a really tight spread on a 3-month money. when we're looking at what the overnight challenge might be of lending your money out and hoping to get it back. So it's reasonable to anticipate that this spread will march higher. And we can then look back at the time in 2008 where it was up at 120 basis points. So I think it would be reasonable to conclude that if this rate gets above 40, then we're going to be looking at a significant liquidity event. And of course, we are in an environment where the Federal Reserve has got a standing repo facility. So if there's a dire need for liquidity, they will print it because the standing repo facility is an unlimited liability on their balance sheet. So it means that the response of the central bank will be to cancel interest rates or interest rate hikes and then to start printing again. And I was saying back in January that I thought it was really quite ridiculous that they were talking about raising rates four times this year. 2 weeks ago, people were talking about them raising seven times this year. And I rather think it's going to be one and done. And I think they're going to have a lot of difficulty doing anything more than that. There's the real potential that what the USA is looking at right now is what Europe looked at after the sovereign wealth crisis. Because the ECB tried to raise interest rates. So that was, I think, one of the big failures of the when I'm just trying to find the ECB's base rate. There we are. They tried to raise rates in the aftermath of the credit crisis. And they never really had a chance. They tried to raise rates in 2011. They got two in. And after that, they had to cut to zero. And that basically resulted in Europe turning into Japan. So everyone was worried at the time about the Japanization of the US economy, but it was actually Europe that had the biggest risk of Japanization. And now I think the bigger risk is of the USA turning into a Japanization type environment for interest rates because we have this phenomenally large budget deficit. There has been an untold quantity of money created in the last 2 years. There's no plan for how to pay back the debts. And there's just no way that raising taxes in an overt manner is going to pass muster with the population. The only way then to get the debt under control will be to inflate it away and to raise taxes in an obtuse fashion. Well, Europe has already tried that with credit or carbon credits, and it's quite likely that the USA will follow suit. But we could be in an environment where they're unable to raise rates, and then that would also help to fuel speculative activity in the kinds of labor-saving devices that could help to control inflation. So robots would obviously then be a significant portion of that market. And AbbVie is ranging now in the region of its all-time peak and at the moment pulling back and could quite easily come back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But we're certainly in an environment where there's going to be interest in labor-saving devices. But right now, we're in the teeth of the crisis. So until we get past this panicky phase, then it won't be immediately apparent where the relative strength leaders will be. But in an inflationary environment, labor saving and thrifting, start to become much more attractive. And it means that certainly there will be attempts to drive productivity gains because of inflation. So that is likely to be something that occurs after this panic phase. In the meantime, I suspect that this is going to be one of the most important charts to pay attention to, because the NASDAQ gold ratio has been the ratio that did what would have been expected after the lows in 2011. It has trended higher in a rhythmic fashion. But it's no longer trending higher in a rhythmic fashion. It has pulled back in a violent manner over the course of the last 3 months. And it's approaching the 1,000-day moving average. And if the NASDAQ breaks down relative to gold, well, then that's going to represent a significant challenge for the hypothesis that growth can outperform real assets. And I'm also paying attention to the advanced decline line for the NYSE, because the advanced decline line generally tends to be the backbone of any big bull market. In order to have a bull market, you need most shares to do well. And on a cumulative basis, when more shares are rising than are falling, then you get these lengthy, consistent trends. Now, there have been occasions when this measure has paused and fallen below the 200-day moving average. And we're seeing another one of those occasions right now. But there's no evidence yet that it is ready to bounce. So even though we've had some climactic-looking activity on indices like the NASDAQ, it hasn't translated into a broad-based recovery. And we'll need a broad-based recovery in order to end this corrective phase. And we haven't seen it just yet. So I've initiated some new investment positions. I've bought things like copper miners and the solar sector because I think they will be beneficiaries from the evolving market and geopolitical environment. But I think that there's still some time left before this medium-term correction bottoms for the wider market. And that suggests that there will be better entry opportunities over the next few months. And the real, I think it's very uncommon that we have substantial strength in the US dollar and commodities at the same time. This is something that does not happen all that often. And when it happens, it's usually an indication of severe stress. So the only obvious conclusion here is that we are in a period of severe stress and that there will be surprises, both on the upside but also on the downside for the sectors most under pressure. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.